The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following program is pre-recorded.
Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show with your host, Eric Metaxas.
Hey there, folks. Welcome back. I'm talking to the author of a brand new memoir. It's called Free as a Jew, Ruth Weiss, pronounced Weiss, but spelled W-I-S-S-E. We're talking about many important things. I want to talk to you about Yiddish literature, and a lot of other fun stuff. But I want to finish this conversation, at least this part of the conversation, with you. So, is it the? I'm just guessing here. It strikes me that the left in America has fallen in love with victimhood, and that they don't like celebrating sometimes because it almost implies, well, then we haven't suffered enough. We want you to focus on our suffering as though something's gained by that. You're saying that's not how people learn. It's not a good thing. But you see that narrative, surely, in American life in the latter part of the 20th century. It just kind of took over. Yes. And people, they want to wallow. They want to be victims. They want to remind you of how much they've suffered because it gives them some kind of perverse status.
Well, that may be true of some people. But, you know, what I saw when I was teaching at Harvard, actually, was something quite different, no less troubling, but very different. People didn't want to fight. And what surprised me most about Harvard and all the 21 years that I taught there, I became involved in faculty meetings as I had never been before when I was at McGill. And I saw that they refused to let ROTC, the Reserve Officer Training Corps, that had always been at the basis of higher education. There was always training of the best and the brightest young people,
right,
during precisely the age when you have to go into the army.
Right.
That's the age.
Sure.
So there was, for 40 years, right, the faculty of Harvard kept ROTC off the campus. They did everything. They kept changing the rationale for keeping it on campus so as not to allow it on campus. What is that about? What they were actually saying to these kids is, forgive me, but this is the way I understood it, America is not worth defending.
That's exactly what they're saying. It's worse than that. They were saying that America is bad, and they're saying that any kind of militarism, or I should say any kind of self-defense, is militarism, is a step away from the quagmire of Vietnam and chest-thumping jingoism. I mean, that's where the left has been for a long time. It breaks my heart, but this is all through the culture, obviously, not just at places like Harvard.
Exactly. So I'm just locking into what you were saying before. It's not just that one wants to see oneself as the victim, is that one does not want to soldier. One does not want to carry the responsibility of protecting what you have built. And here is one, if I may say, one lesson that the Jews should be bringing to the world, that the more accomplished you are, the more you can create, the more you can achieve, the more it is necessary to protect what it is that you have done. If you do not have self-protection commensurate with your achievement, then you will be destroyed. That's just the way it is. And America does not seem to understand that profoundly enough, because it's so much bigger, because it thinks that it's really, you know, what's an attack, even an attack in New York City? Okay, 3,000 people and so on. It's a blip. What's Pearl Harbor? Thing. No, I mean, it's not like that at all. From within and from without, if you are creative, if you are a great country and a great nation, that's when you have to really dig in and know that you have to protect yourself intelligently and thoroughly. Because, you know, I'm not making this up. This simply is the way the world functions. And we see how many players there are out there that are really not getting better from year to year. They're not becoming more self-accountable from year to year. They're becoming more grievance-stricken, and they're the ones who are becoming more aggressive from year to year.
Well, sure. And obviously they have this idea that they want to tear down. I mean, you see this effectively in banning the ROTC from campus at Harvard. They say, well, we don't want that kind of militarism, they would say, yes, on campus. It's right. Distasteful to us. As though their privileges at Harvard weren't being protected by people with guns all around the world. But they right. they seem, with almost inconceivable intellectual sloppiness, to have those views. At what point at Harvard did this become for you a tipping point where you said, I have to push against this, or I'm thinking differently? What did you see go on there? I know you saw the standards of honesty. I mean, there were things that happened there that go beyond the issue of ROTC.
Well, I would say that of all the things that troubled me, and let me just say that there are many things that were wonderful about being there. That should be said, too. The privilege of teaching at a great university and being surrounded by people who are serious scholars with wonderful students. Let's not leave that unsaid. But that shocked me from the first day. And of all the things that distressed me, I would say that remained my greatest distress. And, I addressed it whenever I could, and students knew, I became an advisor to a unit that wanted to be for ROTC on campus and so forth. I mean, I spoke whenever I could for this. And eventually, by the time the war against ROTC was sort of over, I think when Obama came to office, the Army didn't want to be there anymore.
Yeah, you get to a point. Were you at the end of your time at Harvard demonized by the leftists on campus as a controversial figure?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't say demonized. I always saw it the other way. That because there were so few, you see, when I came, there were quite a number of strong conservatives on campus, and there were quite a number of people who would have shared these views, and who were quite visibly Christian, for example.
I can't think of any, but I know that must be the case.
Yes, it was the case, and I know it to be the case, but they all began to kind of retire or just withdraw in some way. And so what happened is, to be one of the very few visible conservatives, you can't imagine how wonderful that was.
Yeah.
Because obviously every student who really felt that way, I mean, for example, the students in the Republican Club, the students for Stand-Up Comedy Club, they asked me to be their advisor.
Wow.
Because it was such a privilege to get to meet all these feisty kids.
Now, you wrote a book on humor, did you not?
I did.
Is it specifically on Jewish humor or just on humor? Or is humor inherently Jewish? That's a question.
Humor is not inherently Jewish, but Jewish humor is very specific. And the book.
Well, it's funny because when we're talking about, speaking as a Christian who values the Bible, to me, the idea of freedom inevitably comes out of the Bible and out of the Jews. Period. Case closed. I'm Greek, so we claim to have invented democracy. But let me just say, there's no question that, Athens doesn't have that to do with Jerusalem, in my opinion. But humor is at its heart a kind of truth telling. There's something about that. Anyway, I know you wrote a book on that. I didn't want to get off on that. Now, let me just ask you before we go to this break. You seem to think that people are beginning to see the end of this, the grievance industry, and that, that people are beginning to appreciate some of the things that you're talking about. Is that, am I reading you right?
Well, I hope so. Let me put it that way. And I always think that it is worth saying what you hope. In other words, stressing that. You've got to be a happy warrior. And it's not that I'm pretending to know something that isn't really there. But yes, sometimes I feel it. People are always asking, are you a pessimist or an optimist?
Right.
Well, by nature, you and I are optimists.
We believe in truth. We'll be right back, folks. I'm talking to Ruth Weiss. Don't go away. Hey, folks, you wish you remembered names better and thought more clearly? Improve your memory with VivaLore Memory Support. VivaLore's founder prayed that God would show her the solution to memory loss when her mother had dementia. Divine encounters, faith, and her background as a pharmacist led Susan Gibson to create VivaLore Memory Support. VivaLore is a premium quality all-natural supplement with 5 to 20 times more nutrients than any other memory supplement. It's won numerous awards and has 3 books independently written about it. Visit VivaLore.com for testimonials about the life-changing improvements people have experienced. VivaLore is for those with normal memory, mild, or severe memory loss. Do not wait till your memory slips. The pathology starts 20 years before your first memory loss symptom. VivaLore is V-I-V-O-L-O-R. Go to VivaLore.com, buy 3, and get 40% off automatically applied. That's 40% off if you order 3. The makers pray that God's healing presence rests on every pill. VivaLore.com, V-I-V-O-L-O-R.com. Check it out. Hello there. I'm talking to Ruth Weiss. Ruth, I'm going to play the role of Eric. You play the role of Ruth. You've written this book, Free as a Jew. You have a background teaching at Harvard. You eventually became a conservative. You are pro-Israel. I think that needs to be said. Why is it, I get the impression, that religious Jews, conservative Jews are pro-Israel? Liberal Jews tend almost to be pro-Palestinian or very worried about Israel, in the way that the Harvard faculty was worried about the ROTC. Well, I mean,
well, the connection you're making is exactly right, I think. Why is that? Well, I don't put it so much as pro-Israel. I cannot for the life of me understand how any decent human being could be anything but pro-Israel. The great question is, why did the Arab world, why did the Arab League organize in 1945 against the state of Israel?
You tell me.
And why? Well,
I have my theories.
Well, I have many theories. I wrote a book about that too, actually, called Jews in Power. Trying to explain anti-Semitism, and which I define as the organization of politics against the Jews. And my sense is that you always have to look at the function of anti-Semitism. Who does it serve, and what purposes does it serve? And it seems very clear that the only glue of the Arab League in 1945 was common opposition to the state of Israel. And that's still in some profound and terrifying way,
yeah,
the only actual unifying element on a political level within that terribly disparate and really fragmented and fractured world. So it plays a very important part among Arab and Muslim societies. And unfortunately, lately, it has been imported into the United States of America quite successfully and driven home here, so that for 25 years after the Second World War, when liberalism was really powerful in this country, partly because one had defeated Nazism, partly because one was still very much united against communism. I mean, the country was really fighting the Cold War.
Except for Lillian Hellman.
Well, except for a minority of people. Yes, is your bête noire.
I just find it funny that there were these people that seemed to be like,
well, yeah.
I think Stalin's okay. Come on, give him a chance.
Liberalism was strong, and so everybody was for Israel in those days.
Right.
For 25 years, you can see, I recommend to everybody to see the movie Exodus or to read the book Exodus. You can't believe that was a bestseller in the 1950s.
Leon Uris.
That's right.
Well, there was a narrative, again, and I grew up with that. And so it's really shocking to me to see the change. I mean, I don't know if you know, I wrote a book on Dietrich Bonhoeffer,
yes,
German
know.
Pastor who got involved in the plot to kill Hitler. And, you know, it is pretty astonishing to see the resurgence of anti-Semitism around the world and in the United States. And, you have a love for Israel. And what led you, I have to ask you, what led you to become a professor of Yiddish literature?
Well, in the memoir, I actually, there was an incident which triggered it. You know, there's a triggering incident. I would have probably landed up there anyway, maybe. But I had met this great Yiddish poet, Abraham Sutzkever, whose name you wouldn't know, but in Yiddish literature and, in world poetry, he's quite superb, one of the great poets of the 20th century. Anyway, I had organized a trip of his to Canada, a speaking tour to Canada, and we became friends. And when he was on the point of leaving around then, he said, well, what are you going to be doing the rest of your life? Meaning that the job I had working as a press officer for the Canadian Jewish Congress was not good enough for me.
And what decade was this?
This was in 1960. 1959, 1960,
wow.
A long time ago.
You were just a kid.
Well, I was married already, and I was I knew that I wanted to work, but I didn't know exactly at what, so I had found this job. I thought I would go into journalism, and this was a job in journalism that involved running his trip.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, you know, I'm thinking of going back to graduate school and studying English literature, which had been my field of honors. You know, I had taken honors in English literature. And he said, well, why don't you specialize in Yiddish literature? And I laughed. I said, and what would I do, teach Shalom Aleichem? And, of course, he was, you know, I don't know which of us was more horrified, because as the words came out of my mouth, I thought, is this you saying it? But I had, you know, Yiddish literature is very prominent in my family. And I knew a lot about Yiddish literature.
I'm sure
literature
most people listening to this program are not aware of the universe of Yiddish literature and theater, but it was a whole world.
It is.
And in many ways, it's forgotten. But thanks to folks like you, obviously, it's not. And I only know a very little bit about it. But so what happened when you said this, and then?
So I said this, and then, of course, I immediately apologized, and I said, what I mean is that there's no place to study Yiddish literature at an advanced level. And he said, oh, yes, there is, at Columbia University. You can take a PhD in Yiddish language. And he knew about it.
Yeah.
So he had kind of set this up, you know, to put this bee in my bonnet, right?
So you didn't move to New York at this point?
I did.
You
for
did?
For 2 years,
in
yes.
the 60s?
Yes, in 1960, 61, I've got my master's in comparative literature at Columbia, specializing in Yiddish literature. And,
wow.
Yeah.
Who was at Columbia? There were some big names there at Columbia in the literature department. I'm just thinking, because that's
well,
so
Lionel
long
Trilling
ago.
Lionel Trilling.
But,
and Fred Dupuy, and they were wonderful. And Richard Chase was my teacher, who was a wonderful teacher.
Well,
and others.
I have to say, I don't read Yiddish that I know of, but I did meet the granddaughter of Shalom Aleichem. Shalom Aleichem is thought of as sort of the Mark Twain of the Yiddish literature, 19th century figure. But his granddaughter, did you ever meet her?
Well, do you mean B. Kaufman?
Yeah.
Yes.
You did.
I did, yes.
She only passed away a few years ago.
Exactly.
I interviewed her when she was 94. She was still doing ballroom dancing.
And wearing very high heels.
Yes. An amazing woman, but
really?
The granddaughter of,
yes, of Shalom Aleichem.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, in fact, you know, why had I said that? Why I had said that? This is, and it's, these things are interesting, you know. I had said, what would I do, teach Shalom Aleichem? Now, why did I say that? Because I didn't have the imagination, because in all the years I had been at college, I had studied Russian literature, German literature, English literature, French literature. But because there had never been Jewish literature of any kind, it took me that minute to think. I hadn't imagined it until that minute. But of course, the minute I said that, I began to imagine it, well, why not? Why shouldn't there be that?
Right.
You know, why not introduce it into the university? And so eventually that's what I did. It seemed, you see, the university was expanding in the 1960s anyway. It was a wonderful period of expansion. Asian studies was coming into the university, African American studies. It was opening up. So it was the most natural thing in the world to introduce Jewish studies, which had never been there altogether, and Yiddish as a part of Jewish studies in Hebrew. So it was that was an age of, you have to be at the right place at the right time.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to think, besides Sholem Aleichem, I can think of I.B. Singer. I can't think of anybody else really at the moment.
Well, Sholem Asch used to be the biggest name.
Uh-huh.
And one of the reasons that he was the biggest name, by the way, is because he wrote a trilogy about Jesus.
Is that right?
Yes.
A trilogy?
A whole trilogy, yes.
In Yiddish?
No. Well, he wrote it in Yiddish, but it was immediately translated into English.
Was it ever translated back into Yiddish?
Well, it wouldn't have had to be.
That was a joke. I got you with that.
Thank you. You did.
But that's amazing. What's the last name there?
Oh, God.
What's the last name?
A-S-C-H.
Asch.
Asch.
Yeah, Asch.
Sholem Asch.
Wow.
And by the way, in Harvard Library, when I began to look up these things and, of what was the holdings of the library, they had many more books by Sholem Asch than by any other Yiddish or Jewish author. Yes, because they had dozens of copies of The Prophet and of the Apostle and of Mary.
Wow.
These books that are, they're wonderful. By the way, they're pretty strong novels.
I understand that Jesus was Jewish. I'm pretty sure he was part Jewish. Mary, of course, was Italian. We all know that. It's just...
Are you going to keep going?
You mentioned earlier Daniel Deronda, the novel. Did you want to talk about... How's that related? When did you stumble onto that? I guess you've studied literature in so many languages. I don't know. We're going to break? Okay. We'll be right back, folks. I'm speaking to the author of a brand new book, Free as a Jew, a memoir by Ruth Weiss. Don't go away. Hey, folks, I've got to tell you a secret about Relief Factor that the father-son owners, Pete and Seth Talbot, have never made a big deal about, but I think it is a big deal. I really do. They sell the three-week quick start pack for just $19.95 to anyone struggling from pain like neck, shoulder, back, hip, or knee pain, $19.95, about a dollar a day. But what they haven't broadcasted much is that every time they sell a three-week quick start, they lose money. In fact, they don't even break even until about 4 to 5 months after if you keep ordering it. Friends, that's huge. People don't keep ordering Relief Factor month after month if it doesn't work. So yes, Pete and Seth are literally on a mission to help as many people as possible deal with their pain. They really do put their money where their mouths are. So if you're in pain from exercise or even just getting older, order the three-week quick start for $19.95. Let's see if we can get you out of pain too. Go to relieffactor.com, relieffactor.com, or call 800-500-8384, 800-500-8384, relieffactor.com. I use it. It works. Hey there, folks. I'm talking to the author of a new book, Free as a Jew. Ruth Weiss is with me. Ruth, I'm just talking in 20 directions at once, but you were friends, I'm amazed, with Leonard Cohen, Saul Bellow, and Isaac Bashevis Singer. That's high cotton, as we say up here in New York. Kind of amazing.
Well, yes.
No? And once you get to know them, they're nothing special, right?
No. No, they're very special, each in his own way. I wasn't exactly a friend of Isaac Bashevis Singer's. I knew him and had occasion to interact
with
him.
He's obviously much older than you.
Yes, but I was very friendly with Saul Bellow at a certain point in his life, and with Leonard Cohen in the easiest way possible. We were at McGill at the same time,
uh-huh.
And we had the same teacher, Louis Dudek. And Louis Dudek was a poet himself, and he decided that he was going to begin a series called McGill Poets, and that the first poet that he was going to publish is Leonard Cohen, who was then a student of his at McGill. So he needed somebody to help him put out the book. And my mother had been in the business of promoting Yiddish books, so I knew all about what it was. And my, by the way, I come from a family that owned the third largest publishing house in Vilna, Poland.
Wow.
So it's sort of in my
You've
blood.
You've got it in your blood.
Yeah.
My
and
goodness.
So I love putting out his book. And so, you know, I just knew him the way one would know somebody in those years.
Your book and you are praised by some big names, Norman Podoritz and Cynthia Ozick. Is it Ozick or Ozick?
Ozick, yeah.
Ozick.
Yeah. She's wonderful.
Has some wonderful things to say about this new book. She's a huge name, of course, in the world of literature. I want to talk to you more about the book, because we're just talking and talking. But so in the book, does the book have, you know, a narrative arc? We were talking about that earlier. Or is it really just memories of all of these different things in your life?
Well, it doesn't flit around.
I would never accuse you of flitting around.
Well, you know, I'm capable of it. But no, I think that what came into view as I was writing was the fact that I had lived one of the most privileged, in the truest sense of the word, lives of anyone of you know, as I said, to be born where I was born under those circumstances and to be able to come to Canada and to live in freedom and then to be able to come to Harvard to teach for 20 years and so on. And I haven't said anything about my family because I just don't want to. I'm a little superstitious about saying too much about the happiness of my family life. But I have been more blessed there than anyone in the world. So to have all these personal blessings, and then the trajectory of my life, of all those blessings, was going in one direction, and the culture that I was a part of was moving in exactly the opposite direction. And this began to be extremely troubling. What do you do in that case? So it made
me... You do what all the other smart Jews did, Norman Podoritz, and on and on. You know, they yes. found magazines. They discovered that, oh, I'm no longer a liberal. I'm now called a conservative because
exactly.
I've clung to these important ideas.
Exactly. Because I have clung to these important ideas, and because we want our country, because we want this precious country to remain as strong as it is, as vibrant as it is. It doesn't happen by chance. And one of the things that I found myself saying more than once at faculty meetings at Harvard is, listen, democracy is not biologically transmitted. And unless you train it, you know, unless you really train each new generation, it doesn't work. So in a sense, I didn't write this memoir at all as a how-to or in any sense as an educational work. I didn't do it consciously, but it seems to me that in writing it, I was able to explain the discrepancy between how a private life can be so successful and how culture can go in such a wrong direction.
Well, gosh, there is so much here. And by the way, you're singing my song, just what you said. I talk about all the time. I've written a book called If You Can Keep It, Franklin's Famous Words to Mrs. Powell about keeping the Republic, that we have to teach these things. And in order to teach them, we have to celebrate them. We have to love them.
Of course.
And, you know, just your one mention of Harvard's dismissal of the idea of having ROTC on campus, that's really... That's an example of where we began to go wrong and began to say that having pride in America is overweening pride, as though by definition pride is hubris or something like that. And so you're saying, look, there's something beautiful about Israel. We should love and celebrate Israel. There's something beautiful about America. We should love and celebrate America. And obviously those ideas in the academy have been gone and going for a long time, and you've lived through it.
Yes. Yes, it's very sad. And the question really is whether we can reconstitute any of that.
That's the question.
I think that's what we're trying to do.
That's what we're trying to do by having this conversation. Well, when we come back, we don't have a lot of time. We've got to have you back, first of all, because there's just so much else to talk about. I want to touch on Daniel Deronda, America, all these things. Folks, please don't forget to go to my website, ericmetaxas.com. Sign up for the newsletter. Hurry up, because we will send you, for example, this interview, the video of this interview. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful place here, and you can watch us have the conversation. Please go to ericmetaxas.com. Sign up for that. We'll be right back. This is for all the
same. Hear the latest reporting and analysis on the big stories of the day on the Daybreak Insider podcast. It's top-notch reporting from SRN News, along with the sharpest insight from Hugh Hewitt, Mike Gallagher, Dennis Prager, Sebastian Gorka, and the voices of townhall.com. The Daybreak Insider podcast. It's your first look at today's top stories. Available at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, and at salempodcastnetwork.com.
Hey there, folks. I'm talking to Ruth Wisse, W-I-S-S-E. What we're talking about in part is a loss of cultural confidence. In other words, when people in the West who have had all the benefits of the West and freedom and the wealth, they kind of become spoiled, and then they begin to look for the dark side. And before you know it, they don't know what they believe, and they essentially open the door to foreign ideas, ideas that are antithetical to everything that has given them the blessings. And so it seems to me in America, the left in particular has lost cultural confidence. That's ultimately what it is. It's a mistrust of anything to do with God or Israel, right, or the Bible or freedom, right, or America.
Right. Well, it's interesting that the words that I've been using, almost the same, is moral confidence. That they lose moral confidence. And you were asking before about how, if I teach Yiddish literature, how I would have come to be giving talks and a series of lectures about Daniel Deronda,
yeah,
which is a book written by, I think, one of the greatest British writers, George Eliot. It is a book, however, about the Jews. And it is one of the most astonishing, insightful, brilliant books imaginable. I think you can spend a lifetime on it the way one can with certain novels of Dostoevsky. So first of all, about this idea that people now have, you shouldn't appropriate something else. You shouldn't write about white people shouldn't write about blacks, and nobody should write about Hispanics.
I shouldn't wear a sombrero or get a tan or any of that stuff,
exactly,
that I do.
So think about this. Her last novel, this great writer writes about the Jewish question, essentially. She's also writing about the woman's question, but she sees the connection between the woman's question, mm-hmm, and the Jewish question in England of her time. What is her problem? Why does she turn to that? Well, it seems to me that what she was really worried about is what you were asking. What is happening to liberalism in England? How can one preserve liberalism in England as it is? And she saw that one of the keys to it is, what is going to be your relation to the Jews? If you cannot accept the Jews as Jews, then you cannot really be a great liberal. And she saw how difficult it was for people to accept it. Yes, so there's this wonderful family that she creates in the novel, the Meyrick family, which is so hospitable. They meet this Jewish girl, and they want to take her in. And if the family wants to marry her, the girls want to adopt her. They love her. They love her. And they say to her, "You know, you wouldn't even have to be Christian." And she says something like, "You wouldn't even have to be Jewish." And she says, "That's the first cruel thing that you have ever said to me." And so the book is really built around this idea of Britain, of England, how it can accept the Jewishness of the Jews. And guess what? It's about Zionism 20 years before the Zionist movement was created. Because at the end of the book, the Jew in the book goes off to the land of Israel.
What year was Daniel Deronda written?
I think in 1876.
Okay. Yeah, it's just amazing. And who was the Jewish prime minister? I can't remember anything now.
Disraeli. Yes.
I mean, it's so interesting. We don't think typically, well, you do, but about Britain and the Jews and the Balfour Declaration coming out of that. We were talking about so much. Earlier we were talking about Sholem Aleichem, and we were talking about, I mentioned Belle Kaufman, his granddaughter, whom I met. The reason I met her was because she was good friends with Joy Davidman Gresham, who married C.S. Lewis. I don't know if you knew that.
Yes.
They were at Hunter College together in the 30s.
Really?
And I was astonished. I was interviewing her about C.S. Lewis, but it's just... It's just fascinating to think about all these different connections. Didn't mean to get you off Daniel Deronda, but
not at all.
There's a great BBC version of Daniel Deronda.
Yes.
People aren't ready for the book yet.
Yes, but it is wonderful.
It only came out about 15 years ago, I think.
Yeah, but it's a good book for our time if one can get into it, because so much of it is valuable for our time. How can people remain distinctively who they are and not be afraid of the most intense kind of interaction with others, especially in the world of ideas, but knowing that you're part of the same wonderful democratic polity and being able to really live as yourself under those circumstances and not feel that you have to appropriate the other or that you have to be afraid of trying to empathize to the greatest degree with the other.
Is it simplistic to say that these ideas with regard to cultural appropriation and cancel culture, that it's basically cultural Marxism, that it's left to the point of Marxism?
Well, yes, I think Marxism has been so watered down. But part of it is that I think people think that internationalism must be better than nationalism. Well, of course, it's the opposite.
And it depends what kind of nationalism we're talking about. National socialist nationalism or a healthy kind of nationalism.
Right. Well, you had Yoram Chazoni on one of your programs, if I'm not mistaken, which is his idea that healthy nationalism is what we're always hopefully talking about.
But I mean, white nationalism, like when you talked about, you know, what are the English going to do with the Jews? That comes to the issue of what kind of nationalism are we going to have? Liberal, open nationalism that's still nationalism, that still celebrates a certain body of ideas, or are we going to be tribal ethnic nationalists, which is what happens if you kick the Jews out? But right now, we don't even have a conversation about what kind of nationalism are we talking about. It's just all derided as ethnic nationalism, as white nationalism, and globalism is touted as some great idea, when I would just say it's simply not.
Well, American nationalism, I would hope, American patriotism and American nationalism is a very, very healthy phenomenon. And the more one knows about America, I think... really the roots of America and what I discovered only when I came to this country, the Federalist Papers, enough to keep you going for a lifetime, genius itself.
Well, Ruth Weiss, I'm happy to say that I'd love to have you back soon because I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you. Congratulations on this book. It
Thank
is Free
you.
As a Jew, a personal memoir of national self-liberation. Free as a Jew by Ruth Weiss, W-I-S-S-E. Again, thank you.
Thank you so much, Eric.
Richard talked with me and he smiled. Said, come and walk with me. Come and walk one more mile. Now for once in your life, you're alone.
You know, I hate to interrupt folks, but it's my program.
I know.
And I can interrupt if I want to. So here's the issue. We're both on vacation right now.
We are.
So we're not really here.
Yeah.
We've just, we want to give you the illusion that we're here.
Yeah,
but we're not really here.
And we're not even together, so.
No, and I'm not talking right now. I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm certainly not talking. But I want to give you the illusion that I'm talking, and that's why you hear the sound of my voice. It's all very convincing, isn't it?
It sure
is.
Well,
Alvin, now that we're on vacation, we should probably, I don't know, encourage the folks with some silly fun. I mean, here's what's not silly.
No.
God is on his throne, and apart from him, you can do nothing. Or bubkis, as it says in the original Aramaic. You can do bubkis apart from God. You got to understand that you should worry about what he thinks, and you should understand that if you've got problems, he's the solution. That's the serious part of this segment. But the fun part of the segment will be coming up any second. You ready?
Go.
Okay, what do we have to share that might be amusing to people listening?
Okay.
They're driving their cars, they're walking their dogs, and they're listening. They're thinking, yeah, go ahead, amuse me. Go ahead, funny man,
amuse
me.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a quick question.
Okay.
What famous person, okay, when he or she turned 50 said, and I'm paraphrasing because I didn't find the exact quote, but they said this, 50, wow, I can't believe my life is one-third over. Who
already,
said that?
Already.
Already, yeah.
Do I have to help you read this?
Okay.
Already.
Already.
50, wow, I can't believe my life is one-third over already.
Okay.
Who said that?
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of funny
because nobody
lives to 150. Yeah.
Okay. Mark Twain, Oscar Wilde, Barbara Streisand, Clint Eastwood, or Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Okay, we know it's not Mark Twain because in the 19th century, men in particular, and nobody really, but especially men, they didn't talk about their age like, oh, I'm 50. Like, you know, now we have a kind of contemporary obsession with youth, which is unhealthy and stupid. But in the 19th century, Mark Twain wouldn't have said that. Same thing with Oscar Wilde. They just didn't think that way. Nobody would have said, oh, 50. They just didn't do that. Okay. Barbara Streisand, she could have said it. Clint Eastwood, I think he's too much of a man's man to worry about his age.
That's a good point.
I just don't see him kind of worrying about his age.
And he will reach 150. He's like 92 right now.
Right.
So.
And then the last one is Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
Barbara Streisand, I don't think she's witty enough to say that. I'm going to go with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he would say, 50, wow, I can't believe my life is one third over already.
That's exactly how he said it. You're very good.
And there was Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Yeah, it was. He has some other, I looked these up, he has some other very funny quotes. He said, money doesn't make you happy. I now have $50 million, but I was just as happy when I had $48 million.
You know what? That's a good point.
It is.
So $2 million, it means nothing.
And he said, I think that gay marriage should be between a man and a woman.
Wait, I don't believe he said that.
He said that? On Brainy Quotes.
Gay marriage should be between a man and a woman for life.
Yeah.
What a great idea. I never thought of that.
Okay.
Well, have we amused you, folks? Do we amuse you? What are we, your clowns? No. You said it. You said you're funny. That's a Goodfellas reference. Don't watch that movie. It's way too violent. Do we have time for Boils My Potato really quickly?
How
about the origin of the word lunacy and lunatic? Let's leave people thinking about this. We've just got seconds. Go ahead.
Because we're living in lunatic times. But you know the word about, you know, when people say they howled at the moon? That's very close because in the Middle English, the Old French, it's a Latin. It comes from the Latin, but it basically means moonstruck. So when you're howling at the moon, it's because you're a lunar, right? Tick.
Lunatic, yes. To be a lunatic, to be loony, comes from, well, they used to believe that the moon caused madness, but people still talk about the full moon having a weird effect on people. I don't know what that's all about, but here's the bottom line. I'm a word guy. I'm a writer. The word lunatic comes from lunar. So moon, madness. Unfortunately for you folks, we're out of time. I apologize. It won't happen again.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
with in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.